The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Jessica Elgott. The polite phrase for it is natural wastage, but for the Conservative Party, it's a huge problem. Its members are getting older and dying, and not enough young people are joining up. So can a clutch of new Tory think tanks help shift attitudes to the Conservatives among the young? We'll hear from some of those hoping to help shape the direction of the party as it begins to look beyond the Theresa May era. Also this week, do you feel that your work is futile? Every day a meaningless trudge towards an ever-distant retirement? You might have what the author David Graeber calls a bullshit job.
I don't think anybody would be doing these jobs were it not for this pervasive morality, which says people are lazy, they won't work unless they're forced to. It's better to work than not to, even if there's nothing to do. We need to fight that morality.
Now, the 2017 election gave rise to the word of the year, youthquake. A surge of young voters had supposedly swept behind Jeremy Corbyn to deny Theresa May a majority. Well, British election survey data has since cast doubt on that surge theory, but it can't be denied that most polls showed a stark age divide. Those under 50 favour Labour, those over 50 prefer the Conservatives, and it's becoming a problem for the Tories. At the launch of the new think tank Onward, the Conservative leader in Scotland, Ruth Davidson, summed it up.
Sometimes as Tories, we just look a bit dour. We look a bit joyless, a bit authoritarian sometimes. We don't get to win if we start hectoring the people that we need to vote for us.
So what to do about it? And how urgently does it need addressing? I'm joined now by my panel, Will Tanner, who was deputy head of Theresa May's policy unit and now director of Onward, Rebecca Lowe of Freer, a new free market pressure group, and Katie Balls of The Spectator. Will, we started the programme talking about a bit of an age divide in British politics. And Ruth Davidson at the launch of Onward was hinting that that might be a problem of tone and image of the Tories. But I guess, is it also a policy problem? Is it that, you know, maybe the Tories don't have the kind of eye-catching policies that Jeremy Corbyn's offering? And what's Onward's kind of aim to address that?
I think at the last election, we did see a shift, significant shift amongst certain demographics away from the Conservative Party towards Labour, especially in the kind of 25 to 34-year-old bracket, where we saw a really significant shift, which the Conservative Party, I think, long-term should be very worried about. If we lose those voters, kind of young professional kind of parents and kind of people up and down the country, we will fail long-term. Whether that's a policy problem or a kind of presentation problem, I personally would say it's both. I think we need to refresh our representation. We need to present a different face and voice to different parts of the country and to different demographics. But we also need to refresh our policy offer so that we are responding to everyday people's concerns, whether that's their ability to get on the housing ladder, whether that's the ability to earn a secure, decent wage, whether that's the ability to pay for childcare, those kind of everyday concerns where people really want government to act in their interests, and they currently don't see enough on offer from the Conservative Party.
I guess one of the things about Labour's offer in the last election, and you know, it's got its critics, but if it's completely free tuition, it's, you know, we're going to put so many billions into housing infrastructure. Is it difficult for the Tories to come up with a kind of similarly very eye-catching, bold offer like that?
I think there is enormous value in the Conservative Party offering policies that work, policies that actually really deliver for real people. I think, for example, what the Conservative Party did with stamp duty at the last budget, cutting stamp duty for young first-time buyers, was an extraordinarily powerful message to send, but it was also something that people felt in their pocket. What Jeremy Corbyn is offering is essentially a millstone of debt around the neck of the very generation he plans to serve, or says that he serves, and high public debt, high public deficits, rising unemployment, rising interest rates. Those are things that people will feel in their pockets, and they'll feel them to the detriment rather than to their benefit up and down the country.
What's your instinct is that of the kind of tone that the Conservative can strike ahead of the next election that might appeal to younger voters? And like you say, we're not necessarily talking about 18-year-olds, we're talking about people under the age of 45. And is it more that, you know, the Conservatives can kind of try and burnish their kind of socially liberal credentials and make a better offer on housing, social mobility, that sort of thing? Or is it about, as some people have said, making a kind of very robust defence of free markets, you know, Airbnb, Uber, winning over young people who are probably in favour of those kind of things versus socialism?
I personally think that the Conservative Party shouldn't go into the next election being ideological. We need to be inspiring. We need to offer people ideas. We need to offer them hope. We need to offer them a clear presentation of our values. That's things like hard work. That's things like community, family, aspiration, enterprise. But it's not saying that we are kind of fundamentalist kind of liberals on one side or kind of extremist socialists on the others. We need to represent the mainstream. And I think the vast majority of people in this country don't consider themselves to be social liberals or economic liberals or socialists or whatever. They don't actually ascribe to those labels, and they probably don't necessarily identify too much with left versus right. They want a good mainstream party representing their interests and responding to their everyday concerns.
What kind of areas is Onward looking to focus on? Where do you think that the focus for the Tory party and outfits like yours should be?
Some of our first projects will be on things like increasing the number of housing and particularly tailoring a housing offer specifically to young people. We'll be focusing on retraining and ensuring that those whose jobs are lost to automation and technology have the ability to retrain and reskill in the new economy. We'll be looking at things like childcare. And we'll also, I think, be trying to campaign and reach new groups of people by directly engaging with them. So that's young people especially, but also black and ethnic minorities and kind of working class voters who the Conservative Party won over some of at the last election, but needs to win many more of if it's going to win a significant majority.
Rebecca, you've just launched another group, Freer, and you've also got quite a lot of high profile backers. And tell us about what the group's offering.
So I think, and to pick up on something Will was just saying, I think there's... sometimes there's a fear of something I think people call ideology. But to my mind, certainly what our approach at Freer is, which is focused on free society, free economy, is more about presenting a coherent clarification and justification for policy. And I think to my mind, this is something that's been missing on the centre and the centre-right part of politics for a while. And we now have, in terms of what Jeremy Corbyn is offering, I think there is a clear focus behind his views, whether you agree with them or disagree with them. I think we live in a time in which state intervention, whether it's authoritarianism abroad or whether it's increased indirect regressive taxation here in terms of policies to do with the sugar tax, or you see talk of energy price caps, this idea that the state intervention is good and right without any kind of argument against that. To my mind, we need a compelling alternative to that. I think an alternative which is based on what works, but also on what is right. Now, if you want to call that ideology, that's fine. But to my mind, we're talking about clarification and justification. So I think the centre-right needs a proper alternative to this idea that the state should intervene and that is always good and right for people. And that's certainly what we're trying to do. Our view is that free societies and free economies give people the choice to take control of their own lives. So this is a point that, you know, increased state intervention is not only often counterproductive, but it can destroy the bonds of chosen community and also erode personal responsibility, which is essential to a good society.
Those two policies you just mentioned there, the sugar tax and the energy cap, they're two things that strike me about, the thing that strikes me about those is they're Tory party policy. Is it that one of the first focuses for you is to kind of shift the direction of the Conservative Party rather than thinking of it as a way to reach out to voters?
I think, first of all, it's important to say that the Freer is not a Conservative Party group. I mean, it's an independent group, and we're keen to engage with people of all parties and none. Yes, as you'll notice, if you've had a look on our website, our parliamentary supporters are all Conservatives, but we're very keen to find people. I mean, if John McDonnell wants to change his views, that's going to be for the good of society. So we're very keen to engage across the board. But yes, I think there has been a move towards this idea on all sides of the political spectrum to an unthinking, I think, embrace of the state as the answer. And if it's not just the state, I mean, we see talk about social liberalism as well. And to my mind, as you intimated earlier, young people particularly, I think, are in favour of social freedoms. We see a lot of problems in universities. We've actually just launched a paper a few weeks back by Kemi Badenoch on free speech. And we've been just astonished and delighted by the response we've had from young people. We took it up to Liverpool the night that we launched it. We had a packed room full of students saying, look, we're not your snowflakes. We want to engage with this stuff. And sure, you know, we're not seeing journalists being killed like in Belarus or Russia, but it's a slippery slope. And I think it's super important to engage with these things. And the idea that we can stereotype young people and say either they're all Corbynistas, or whether they're all in favour of clamping down, or indeed that they don't care about the fact that the tax burden for personal and business tax burden is on its way to being the highest in 50 years. I think there are massive differences within as well as between demographic groups, and I worry about any kind of approach which tries to stereotype in that sense.
Katie, what's your take on the mountain that there is to climb for the Tories and whether these kind of initiatives will help them attract? And yeah, we are talking about sort of voters under 45.
Yeah, I mean, I think the local elections were better than lots of Tories expected, so there's a little bit more confidence. But Dom Cummings of Vote Leave recently made quite an important point, which is since 1945, there's only one party that's seeking a third term in government has managed to increase its number of seats. So if the Tories want to stay in power, let alone have a majority, they have a very difficult task ahead of them, and they need to work out how they can rejuvenate while in government. So you can see why all these think tanks are going to, in theory, do something quite positive here. And as someone who, perhaps this says more about my social calendar, I want to, someone who's been touring the new wave of think tanks, it's nice to see there's a lot of enthusiasm. You also see a lot of the same faces. So there are some MPs who are obviously really want to be involved, whether it's perhaps for their own personal career reasons or because they're so brimming with ideas. So I think the proof will be in the pudding, but you're also seeing different schools of thoughts. And I think with Freer, what's interesting is they are obviously moving away from this big state idea, and I think they are tapping
quite a Theresa May idea, in fact, especially from the beginning of her premiership. That was something more state intervention was something that she sort of started to say could be a conservative idea in some cases.
Yeah, and there are lots of Tories who think the reason that they didn't get a majority, you know, even increase that they lost a majority in the last election, is because they weren't conservative enough. I think that is a debate that's still going on. And they looked at the manifesto and they think Theresa May is actually more Miliband than Thatcher when it comes to the economy. So I think these think tanks, in a way, give the chance for people to fresh out their ideas and maybe mean that they can make more convincing arguments. I think there's also a chance that part of the reason we're getting these think tanks is, should there, perish the thought, be a leadership election in this parliament, some politicians will have vehicles that they can perhaps move on or bases. But I think from an optimist's perspective on this, it's surely a good thing. Lots of people are coming together and trying to come up with ideas, because I think there is a problem in government where it is tiring, and I think the Tory party is very tired, and you don't have a majority, so it's really hard work trying to come up with policies you can get through. I had one MP say to me, I said, well, why are we suddenly getting all these think tanks? Because a few years ago, it didn't seem like it was going to happen. They said, because Theresa May, and Will might disagree with me on this, because Theresa May is quite controlling, when she seemed that she was on course for a very large majority, no one really wanted to stick the head above the parapet. But now it seems like Number 10 are going to let these things happen. They accept that people want to have these debates, which is why you're seeing these forums open.
One of the things that is quite interesting is you say that when you, and it probably says something about my social life as well, that I've been to also most of these launches, and you do see the same kind of new generation of Tory, younger Tory MPs who are, you know, have been maybe been there in Parliament since 2015, or even some of them since 2017. And there's been, you know, kind of a lot of whisperings about one of the ways that the PM could refresh her offering is by promoting more younger Tory MPs. You won't be surprised to hear where those whisperings come from. But do you think that's the case, that one of the ways that she could in the next couple of years do is start promoting people like the kind of MPs who are backing these initiatives like Onwards and Freer? And also the CPS recently launched the Blue Book, which is a big policy portfolio of ideas from lots of younger Tory MPs. They're clearly people putting themselves about there.
Yeah, I think there's definitely a chance. I think it gives them, I think it gives Lees MPs a chance to, you know, prove their worth and come up with ideas. But the government also has a big problem in the sense that there is an order normally. So if they start promoting the 2017ers, you are going to make a group of perhaps 2015, even 2010, quite annoyed. They think they have waited their turn. And in a hung parliament, it's actually, as you can tell, more difficult to make people annoyed. But I think with these groups, there is a chance. I mean, there's also a criticism so far that Theresa May and her reshuffles hasn't wanted to promote anyone, you know, too promising, because it would give way to this talk. But I think where she can do it is if you reshuffle your junior ministerial ranks. That is not a direct threat to her premiership. And these people, people like Kemi Badenoch, Bim Afolami, you know, coming up with ideas, obviously feel like they have something to bring, and maybe in the next few years they'll get a chance to bring that to a department.
One of the things that we haven't talked about, I'll ask you about this, Will, is at all is, and actually I thought it was conspicuous a bit by its absence in a lot of the launches, is talking about Brexit, which is the main thing that's occupying the minds in government, and also probably a thing that younger voters might have concerns about. One of the that we know that younger voters are more likely to oppose Brexit, although that obviously gets more the younger you get. And that might be one of their real concerns about backing the Tories if they feel strongly about remaining in the EU. How can the Tories win back voters like that?
So Brexit is not something that Onward will be directly looking at. And it's kind of one of the great luxuries of Onward that I don't have to concentrate too much on the kind of intricacies of the most difficult kind of constitutional negotiation this country has faced in a long time. But I think what we do need to do is demonstrate that the Conservative Party is about more than Brexit. At the moment, Brexit is taking up an enormous amount of government's bandwidth for obvious reasons. And I think it's right that the government puts a lot of its energy into Brexit. But it can't be the only thing that this government, that Theresa May's leadership, can be known for. The government does need to set out a kind of broad-based agenda that gives people that hope and optimism and kind of accepts the need for change. I think what Theresa did incredibly well on her first day as Prime Minister when she stood outside Downing Street and gave that speech, which people across the political divide remember and who it resonated with. She articulated something which lots of people in this country feel, which is that the system wasn't working for them, whether that's the economy, whether that's the kind of a political class, whether or not that's kind of different parts of the economy or parts of this country's geography that have sped ahead of others. And that's what the Conservative Party needs to be focusing on, a series of policies which give people who haven't had opportunity more opportunity, which give those areas that possibly voted for Brexit, not just because of the European Union, but for some of the economic and social reasons that have afflicted them for many decades. We need to give those people hope, and we need to articulate a series of policies which respond to their needs on housing, on work, on things like childcare, and give them kind of reasons to vote Conservative more than a Brexit vote, which bluntly most voters just want the government to get on with, deliver, and then make the country better in the process.
Rebecca, what's your thoughts on that? Do you think that obviously there's right-wing free market arguments in favour of Brexit? Those arguments didn't really win over a lot of younger voters at the referendum, but is that the kind of arguments that you'll be making?
Certainly. I mean, I think our approach since we launched and before that, when we were thinking about this, is to focus on sort of post-Brexit Britain. Brexit is happening and there are a lot of challenges, but there are also a lot of opportunities to be engaged. So one of the things that we're focusing on for is the sort of technological advance. We've been looking at this, we've been having some fun. We had Matt Ridley on our podcast the other week and we talked about robots and all the opportunities. I mean, there are some threats too, but there are some great opportunities with technological advance. The next big paper we have coming out, should be next month, is looking at blockchain in terms of, again, opportunities. Eddie Hughes is writing us a fantastic paper about trust and data. I think these are topics that engage young people, as indeed I think they engage people across the board. I think it's important that we look ahead and we think about what ways we can, there are all kinds of swathes of policy areas that we haven't had any control over. I mean, if you just look at something like farming, I mean, for 40 years, British politicians have tried to come up with ways in which they can address this in a domestic sense and just haven't been able to. So Brexit, regardless of where you were in terms of the vote a couple of years back now, there are great opportunities for policymakers, for politicians, for people across the country. As Will said, there are people who've struggled with the way in which we have economic imbalance across the country. We have all kinds of problems. Housing, obviously, chance to look at to liberalise regulations, I hope. We have control now, and I think that's a really exciting and positive note. So we're certainly looking to the opportunities that we all have as a country post-Brexit.
Do you think that kind of idea of liberalising regulations, that's certainly one of the things that I think probably concerns quite a lot of people in the sort of younger demographic, you know, is Brexit an excuse to tear up human rights laws, environmental regulations? What can you say to people about those concerns?
I think in terms of, well, to focus on housing, I think the regulatory framework we have has been very restrictive. I think housing supply is very constricted by the regulations we have, and this is a great time to redress all kinds of policy areas, whether those are things that have been restricted by the EU or have been restricted by a kind of one-track mindset. So that's something I think in terms of regulations which will be which might be removed post-Brexit, EU regulations, whether that's to do with human rights or whether that's to do with environmental concerns, I think all the more reason for us to be talking about those things now so that we can be making sure that we make the right decisions here, because regulations might be good, regulations might be bad. You know, you can be the harshest, strongest libertarian in the world, but you're not an anarchist, right? That's the whole point. You think there are some things that the state should do, and I think that's why exactly why we should be having those conversations.
Katie, we all hope it is a long time until the next general election. At least political correspondents definitely do. Do you think the Tories have got enough time to make over their image?
I mean, the problem is Brexit is just so all-consuming that you can say that they're making good progress on some things. You can say that they've successfully launched Hugger Husky 2.0 with Michael Gove. So they are definitely building on the environment, which lots of people credit to a think tank that's not here, which is Bright Blue. So you can say these things, but then ultimately you don't know what it's going to look like in terms of Brexit by the time of the next election. So, and I think that's going to dominate it a lot. So if, for example, there is an early election because MPs don't back this deal and somehow that brings about a chaotic situation, I don't think any level of perhaps a positive domestic policy is going to override that. But then if they can get a deal which is broadly accepted by people, there are a few gripes on each side, then you can see how with a positive vision, and I think positivity is one way they can, to lots of young voters who don't like Brexit, they see it as a fully negative experience. So if they can make people hopeful about what this party can offer people, partly through the opportunities of Brexit, which is also the country as it is, because most Tories hope Brexit will kind of be getting done by that point, then I think these policies will start to have a bigger effect. But I think as much as people want to leave Brexit to one side, it will dominate the next election, I think.
Thanks so much, everyone. And you can follow more of our political coverage on theguardian.com. Now, are millions of us really doing work that serves no useful purpose at all? And if so, what can we do about it? It's a question that has occupied anthropology professor David Graeber, whose new book is called Bullshit Jobs. Earlier, he came in and explained the idea to our own Heather Stewart.
David, perhaps we should start by asking you to set out what you mean by this phrase.
Well, for me, a bullshit job is a job which even the person doing the job secretly believes does not need to exist or shouldn't exist. Normally, as part of the conditions of employment, you have to pretend there is a good reason for it to exist, and that hence the degree of bullshit. You know, you have to pretend that the job is doing something it isn't really doing. Either that you're working when you're not actually doing anything at all, or that your work serves some meaningful purpose when secretly you think it doesn't.
And give us some examples. Talk about those. One of the examples in the book is those German contractors, for example, isn't it?
I started with an example of a guy called Kurt, who is a subcontractor to a subcontractor to a subcontractor to the German military. And this sort of thing happens ostensibly in the name of efficiency. They outsource all these functions. But as a result of this endless multiple outsourcing and outsourcing of outsourcing, this guy is in charge of moving computers, so that if a German military officer wants to move his desktop from one office to another, he has to go to personnel, and they have to go to someone else, and they have to go to someone else, and they finally goes to him, and he has to drive usually 200, 300 kilometers in a rented car, fill out some paperwork, move the thing, and then fill out another bunch of forms, seal the box, and send it to another person, and so forth down the line. And all of this is done in the name of efficiency. It's not like they really need these other guys to tell them how to move computers. Yet somehow, you know, there's these layers on layers of bureaucrats that have been created by privatization.
And it's, your argument is that this is happening increasingly, isn't it? This is a kind of increasingly common phenomenon.
Yeah, I think actually the whole rhetoric of the rise of the service economy is essentially false. Because, you know, when you say service economy, you think that means people who work in, who press shirts or serve coffee or cut hair. But actually, if you look at real services like that, it's pretty much constant at 20% for the entire century. There's been no change at all. What's changed is there's a gigantic explosion of administrative, clerical, and supervisory work. And that gets categorized
underservice, but it's not. It's basically paper pushing. And that's the area where I talk about bullshit jobs. Hmm. Actually, the interesting thing is the more useful and necessary your work, the less you're likely to get paid and the worse the conditions are likely to be. The people who get respect are often the people who are doing almost nothing.
And tell us about the people that you, because there are a lot of first-hand stories in the book, aren't there, about people doing these kinds of jobs where they know they're only there, you know, for appearance, or they're doing something where they can't really see a tangible effect.
I asked people, I have a lot of followers on Twitter, so I figure there's the easiest way to get accounts. I'm slightly biased sample, obviously, but
just a bit.
There's about 60,000 of them at that point. So I said, oh, okay, have you ever had a job that was just totally pointless, you know, which really didn't need to exist? Tell me all about it. You know? So I made up a Gmail account, do I have a BS job or what? @gmail.com. And I was deluged with responses.
I mean, bet you were.
Yeah, I got hundreds. And some of them were kind of pointless, but a lot of them were great. Some of them were very short, a paragraph. Some of them were 20 pages long, detailed accounts of my history and psychological analysis of what was going on, or sociological analysis. And it was very, very useful. In a way, the book kind of wrote itself. And in the process of that, and back and forth, and people would propose or ideas of how certain jobs came about, I developed a typology that essentially there's five types of bullshit jobs. There's flunkies, goons, duct tapers, box tickers, and taskmasters.
Okay, you're going to have to spell those out a bit.
Okay.
Tell us about a flunky.
Flunky's pretty obvious. Flunky
we
is,
can guess,
you're,
yeah.
Yeah, you're only there to make someone else look good. Okay, so that's flunkies. That's
right,
easy.
Right, goons.
Goons are a category I had to make up because so many people wrote it in. Essentially, they're people who are there. Your entire industry is that only exist because you only need one because somebody else has one. Like a corporate lawyer. You know, if there were no corporate lawyers, you wouldn't need corporate lawyers because you only get a corporate lawyer if you're the other side.
Don't you need a corporate lawyer in case you get sued?
Yeah, by a corporate lawyer. I mean...
Fine, yeah.
All right, so that's goons. That's easy. Box tickers is pretty obvious. Box ticking is when you basically hire someone to allow you to say you're doing something that you're not actually doing. You know, a commission of inquiry would be a great example of that. People are taking bribes. That's terrible. Let us investigate this and, you know, set up a committee and...
So kind of compliance type.
Compliance.
Stuff.
There's a huge compliance industry.
Yeah.
All right. So that's box ticking. Then finally, taskmasters is kind of obvious. It's they're supervisors who are supervising people who don't need supervising. There's a lot of... offices I heard about where there are twice as many managers as there are actually workers. Finally, there's the type of taskmaster who actually makes up entire bullshit jobs. And I managed to get one or two of those who actually admitted
it's like a kind of Uber bullshit job.
Yeah, meta bullshit. and that was hard, but a few people were willing to come clean.
All right, so tell us what your answer is, David. Tell us what your solution is.
Well, you know, I'm not a policy guy, right? But in fact, I'm suspicious of the very concept of policy. It always strikes me as a little undemocratic. But I would say this. I don't think a campaign to reform this is going to work. I think that what we need to do is give people other options. I don't think anybody would be doing these jobs were it not for this pervasive morality, which says... people are lazy. They won't work unless they're forced to. It's better to work than not to, even if there's nothing to do. We need to fight that morality. And I think the best way to do that is through some kind of policy of basic income. I used to think that reducing working hours was the best idea. And I still think that's that would be a good idea.
But it's what Keynes thought we'd be doing by now, wasn't
exactly,
it?
Exactly, yes. And that's how I started the original article. I said, well, why aren't we working 15-hour days? It's as if we actually have eliminated all those jobs that existed in the 30s, except instead of taking time off, we just invented these meaningless ones just so we can continue to work 40-hour weeks. It doesn't make any sense. But to some degree, it's just morality. We're all convinced that anybody who isn't working harder than they'd like to work at something they don't particularly enjoy is a bad person and doesn't deserve the help of their community, shouldn't be loved, shouldn't be supported. I think reducing the working week would be a way to start that, but it would be very hard. There was a time when most people worked 9 to 5, but that's not true anymore. I mean, look at someone like me. I have a salary, but basically I'm supposed to be working all the time. There's no way to really regulate what I do. And if you tried, you'd have to create a huge bureaucracy to look at all the casualized people, the contract people, this, all, you know, and that would just make the government bigger and more intrusive. And I don't like that idea. I believe in left-wing anti-bureaucratic policy. So I think the ideal left-wing anti-bureaucratic policy would be universal basic income. I think that if you just divorced recompense from work and just say, look, here's enough money to live on, everybody gets the same, and after that it's up to you, well, people would be free to decide for themselves what they wanted to contribute to society. And the very fact that there are all these bullshit jobs is really rebuts the two biggest objections people usually give. One objection is people are lazy. If you just give them money, they won't do anything. They'll, you know, a significant proportion will just sit around watching TV or playing cards all day and nothing will get done. Well, I always say look at prisons, right? Because in prisons, you know, you have the option of sitting around watching TV all day and playing cards, and they take away prisoners' work rights to work as a way of punishing them. So even though these are pretty antisocial people, otherwise they wouldn't be in prison, right? You know, they actually would rather be working in the prison laundry than just sitting around. But even aside from prisons, I mean, the very fact that people who are paid to do nothing all day are so unhappy kind of shows that that's not the case. And the second objection people have is once they concede that people would actually want to do something with their lives, even if they got paid, they'd say, well, sure, they'll do things, but, you know, who's to say whether what they decide they want to contribute to the society is actually useful? So suddenly the world will be full of bad poets and crank scientific theories and, you know, annoying street mimes and things like that. And, you know, and nothing will get done. But if 40% of the people in this country already think they're doing nonsense, how could it be any worse than it already is? How will they come up with a division of labor worse than we've already got? Plus, at least they'll be having fun. You know, at least they'll enjoy being bad poets rather than filling out forms all day and being miserable.
David Graeber there. And David's book, Bullshit Jobs, is out now. Well, that's all we have time for now. My thanks to Rebecca Lowe, Katie Balls, Will Tanner and David Graeber. Follow all our political coverage at theguardian.com/politics. The producers were Phil Maynard and Simon Barnard. I'm Jessica Elgott. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.